Welcome to the Centurion Running Podcast, everybody, and especially today's guest, the one and only Robbie Britton. How are you, Rob?
I'm all right, James. I'm all right. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm so good right now. So happy to be speaking to you. And I'm sure the listeners are happy that it's not just me prattling on at them today. It will be broken up with the sound of your lovely voice.
I'll try my best, obviously.
Where are you right now? Fill us in on your whereabouts in the world.
I'm at home in a small hamlet called Massaranga in the Piedmont region of Italy.
It's beautiful there, right? I've still not visited you. How long have you been there now?
Coming up to 4 years. And yeah, someone I consider a friend still not come out to visit. I think I visited you a couple of times in the meantime, though, James.
Yeah,
you live in Wee Hampstead, so I guess we're giving away each other's geographic locations. We got nice trails on the door here. You should come. We can do 1,500 meter climb in about 8K from the door.
Punchy. You've had quite a stream of guests recently, though, right? You've had the best of British coming out to visit and international.
I like the other week we had a team of 24 hours in the room. 24-hour runners in the room who had a combined personal best of, like, I think it was 780 or so. It was high. It was a very high 780 between the three of us, which is good. I wasn't even the best 24-hour in my own house, which is the first time that's happened in a really long time, because Damien Carr was here and he's got a 262. So, yeah, it's the guests that have, a couple of chaps been coming out to help us, with Rob Payne come out as well, just to help with the training. So it's quite enjoyable to run those long 24-hour miles with company.
Why are you doing that? Tell the listeners, what are you up to as an athlete at the moment? You're focused on what race?
I'm running the Torino 24-hour in 15 days.
And that was the locale of your biggest success back in the day, right? Your third place at the World Championships, no less.
Yeah, it's just in the same park, Parco Ruffini in Turin. Going back there. Different loop. It's only a 1K loop this time, so that's not too bad.
What year was Turin? Was that 14, 15?
2015.
Wow. Yeah. 8 years later. Time has flown by.
Yeah.
So for those that don't know Robbie, we'll try and find out a bit about him. I've known Robbie, well, I'd say a very long time now. And maybe we could try and work out the first place we met. I probably... North Downs Way 100, 2011, would that be right, Rob?
Yeah, I guess it would have been along the way and then in that car park where it finished.
And then did we run Caesar's Camp together after that? Was that the October following that?
After, yeah, when I beat you at Caesar's Camp, because the records were the results, say.
Yeah, let's come on to that. But yeah, so Robbie was there at our very first ever race here at Centurion, a 2011 North Downs Way 100, which... We also had a 50-mile and a marathon going that day, something we've not done since. It was our first race of any distance, and Robbie showed up, super relaxed, with a very memorable crew of your old man and Mick Seymour, who would go on to become one of the most solid 24-hour team crew members we've ever had, really. Just an amazing bloke. But Rob, you weren't really in the mix at halfway, were you? And then you turned around and legged it all the way back to Farnham and only went and won the race, didn't you?
I was fifth halfway, and Neil Bryant was first, one of our other coaches.
That's right.
An hour and a half ahead of me. I'd run most of the first half of Alan Rumbles, but Alan Rumbles did end up in an ambulance. So like
he did. Like he was my first ever medical emergency at a race. Anyway, carry on.
And then, I caught Neil with about 5K to go. I remember turning my head torch off and like just sneaking up behind him and be like, "Hey, mate, come on, let's jog together," whilst having no intention to jog together. that's still it's the closest I've got to a negative split in 100 miler. I think it was 1947 with the finish time, and like the first half was 9:50 and the second was 9:57. So it was close to even splits, and I stopped to rearrange some of the markers on the way back.
Cause I remember that. Yeah. Some reprobates had been out, trying to send runners off course, hadn't they? And you took the time to actually fix it. So not only did you win the race, you won the Good Samaritan Award as well.
Could have cost me the race.
And then shortly after that, we met at Caesar's Camp, where we both entered the 100? Were we both running the 100 that year? And was that where we both took forever and I took slightly less long than you, but on the results, you're definitely an hour in front of me for some reason. And therefore, the one time I actually beat you in a race, you still come out on top somehow. The result.
I feel we showered ourselves with glory on that. I mean, my mum paced my old penultimate lap with me, and by my mum paced, she walked around with me. I was wearing mostly football kit and some work clothing and a pair of shoes that I'd borrowed from someone else, but basically he'd thrown them out. And I had like, this is, Dan would be loving this. They were secondhand shoes that didn't really fit me. And they left these 2 pence piece blisters on both of my heels.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, it's great.
But I remember I'd had chafing so bad, I'd sit in the car and I pointed the aircon at my nether regions and fell asleep. Woke up, no idea if I'd missed the cutoff, but I still had time to walk the last couple of laps in full tracksuit. So we must have looked a right old pair out there at the end of that.
I can't remember you beat me though. That's weird. But from my memory, I was waiting for you at the finish line. I gave you a cup of tea as you came over and was like, "Well done, James. You can go far in this sport, lad." That's my memory. I don't know what you've got.
Well, I've got the official results that aren't the ones that are where you're in front of me. I've got the original results where you were 28 something and I was 27 something. But I mean, it doesn't matter. You've trounced me so far. Everything else we've ever done, it's really just another nail in the coffin of my athletic career, isn't it, really? But anyway, I think, and we'll come on to the rest of the journey, but I like to think of you as the one of the runners who's got the best range. Would that be fair? Like, across your athletic career, would you say that's a fair assessment, that you've done it all from the very short to the very long and been pretty successful at everything?
A jack of all trades, are you saying? I got a decent range. Like, I guess my specialism is the 24-hour stuff, the flat stuff. I don't refer to myself as built for hills, but I dabble in the trails and I've done all right. So I suppose, yeah, the range is there. I'm all right at 3,000 meters as well. I've done a second at a 3,000 meter race once. So I guess there's some decent range in there.
Yeah, but you knock out a fast 5K, you know, on the road, seemingly whether you're in training or not. You've always just had the, I know, relatively speaking to the upper echelons of British shorter distance endurance running, it's not in the mix. But, you know, you are quick. I mean, you've always been quick. But then, yeah, whether it's on the road, the trail, or in the mountains, and over anything from vertical K to 24 hour, you've done a lot, and you've raced a lot, right? You've done a lot of different things in your life. You've always enjoyed a good race. Is that fair?
I do like racing, and I think variety is important in training, and especially if you're doing this for quite a long while. If you're not just doing the same things, it can get boring. But if you do like to race, and yeah, that's fair to say, I do love a race. I will race an old lady, like just walking along the street and give her a swift elbow if needed to take the victory. But like, kind of balancing that around training smart for races has meant that, yeah, I do a variety of distances, because if I only did 100 milers, I wouldn't be able to race anywhere near as much as I'd enjoy. So I mix it up. And like, even training for the 24 hours, like last year, I had 3 weeks where I ended up doing a 55K on the trails. And the plan had been to then do another 45K trail race 2 weeks later. And that was kind of far out from the 24, so not close enough that it was going to impact it. But good way to get a long run done. Mm. And then the club called me in to do a 10K in between. And we've got a club out here called the Climb Runners. And he refers to me as the concrete runner. Always reliable. I think it's a compliment in Italian.
But I'd say so. sounds like a character out of the Avengers. But yeah, no, I think that is a compliment.
So he called us in for a 10K. And yeah, just I guess, like, and I've chatted about my coach, Tom Craggs. I've chatted about with him. I don't know if it's that I'm particularly good at anything beyond the 24-hour stuff, but any distance, any race you set me out at, I'll do all right. I'll reach my close to my potential. Like, I'm not the best 10K runner. I'm not the best like marathon or anywhere in between. But in terms of reaching my potential, I do all right. I get close to that. So like, that's why I think my specialism is I'm not particularly fast. Remember, like, was it Ruth Croft? I was running with her once, and she we were kind of set off at different times. She's catching up. And she said, "I knew it was you because you run funny." Like, I don't like, in my head, that sticks, because I don't feel like a fast runner. I line up with, and it's all relative. At the start of an ultra, I'm probably reasonably quick, but then I go and do, I did Armagh 5K, which was last night, I think. And there's like 130 people breaking 15 minutes for 5K. Yeah. I ran 15:25. So like, yeah, it's all relative. I'm fast for a 24-hour runner. I'll probably leave it at that.
Well, I mean, let me just quickly summarise. Like 2:29 marathon, most notably, I think, one of your better runs. And I know you faded very slightly at the end, but 2:57 for 50K last year. I mean, that's some performance. Third place at the World 24-Hour Champs. That's third overall bronze medal, 261K. Amongst other events you've run, highlights, you've done all of ours, I think, bar the Autumn 100. Is that fair? And I think you've won them all as well, haven't you?
No, I've won South Downs and North Downs.
Not Thames Path. Second at Thames Path.
Craig Holgate,
yeah.
Haven't done the Autumn 100, haven't done Wendover, and haven't done the 50s. I do want to do some of the 50s at some point. But I've done less. When you started, I did all of them, and then I branched out.
Yeah, UTMB, which we ran together again when they amended the course. That was a shambles that year, wasn't it? Jeez.
Interesting, yeah.
You went back and did much better at that. Sparta. I nearly caught you there. 24-hour racing. Cappadocia, CCC, 11th. I mean, that's, you probably don't look back on that thinking that was a nailed-on run, but 11th at CCC. I mean, the depth of competition. God, there's a lot here. There's too much to mention, really. But I think, like I say, 15 and a half minute 5K, 2:29 marathon, 2:57 50K, all the way up to 24-hour third place. And I mean, that's what I mean by range. But you've done it in the mountains on the trail too. If you had like a standout race, like a race you remember more than any other for whatever reason, what is it? What's your like career highlight? If someone said to you, I remember Dick Kern used to get us to write this on the Grand Union entries. What's your best ever run?
Maybe Canterbury 10 when I beat Paul Navesy.
55 minutes.
Yeah, something like that. It's a hilly course, that. Not often you beat like a 2:16. It wasn't a 2:16 marathoner then, but
no.
Over 10 miles. I'll hold that on him. Paul's still, he's still ahead of me in terms of victories. Honestly, there's been lots. Like, I really enjoy like so many different distances. According to the wonderful scoring systems of ITRA and UTMB and whatever scoring systems you like, my best result was last year on the trails at Broken Arrow, 52K race. That didn't go particularly well. I think I was 11th there as well. But what's my best? It's hard to look beyond that one in Turin. Ask me again in 2.5 weeks and I'd love to have a different answer.
Okay. So there's a 24-hour coming up, but what's still on the bucket list for you? I mean, the thing is, you're only relatively young in this sport. I think the benefit for you and I was, I mean, you're 4 years younger than me, but we started at 23 or whatever and did a lot fairly early doors, which may have been good and may have been bad in some ways. But, you know, you've done an awful lot, but you're still several years from hitting the big 4:0. What's out there from here? What's the journey look like as a runner for you from here?
I don't even bloody know. Weirdly... So like my goal last year was to race the 24 at the end of the year and then spend this year on the trail.
Yep.
I got caught COVID 8 days before the last race in December. So I bumped things along. This 24-hour wasn't on the original schedule. I want to go out and do some more trail racing this year. Long term, the Tour de France is right up the top of my bucket list. I'd love to return to Spartathlon and do better. There's just a lot of races out there that really kind of excite me. Still, this is a nice thing, right? I'd love to go back to UTMB and do well there. I think I've got a strong performance there. So it's, I guess it's getting back on the trails, making the most of where I live. Like I really do love road running, and I've got a few decent, I've got a variation on one loop, kind of linear out and back stuff here that I do a lot of. And I'm looking forward to being able to kind of access some of the trails and different road loops we've got here within my training a bit more when it's less road focused. So I'm looking forward to, spending a bit more time in the outdoors here and getting ready for some trail races. But so far this summer, there isn't, I might be going back to Broken Arrow just because it seemed to be a race that suited me all right. But in terms of that, there's so many great races in Italy, like just some really, really kind of every little kind of Tom, Dick and Harry like just tiny little trail race. Like there's one near us this weekend called the Winter Brick Trail, right? It started a few years ago and it was kind of this tiny little race and we went along with our club mates. And now this year you've got, there's two, Francesco and Ale from our club who are really, really good kind of just around that national team level Italian runners. Franco Colla's turning up. Nice. The guy who won it last year turn up. There's a guy called Matty who's a Salomon runner who's like an 860 on it. Like, and that's just a, like you're winning cheese and you're winning like outsized large jumpers and shit like that. and you're getting like five or six people there that would clear the floor at any other race. And that's just our local, like I chatted to Francesco today. He said, oh, it's only Winter Brick Trail. It doesn't matter. And I was like, yeah, but the level of competition is fantastic. I want to be able to go and do, there's so many like that that I want to go and do. So the short answer is the tour.
Come all the way back round, it's the tour. Yeah, yeah, I get that. And I see why. Yeah, having been there once myself, I totally get that. And it seems to be the one race that really resonates more than any other. I think, you know, having spoken to the several or handful of very decent British runners that were at the tour in 2022, every single one of them's got plans to go back either this year or next. And some did great, some won the race, some didn't finish, some were all right. But everybody's like, yeah, I need to get back there. And it's so rare that something that long and arduous, I think, has that impact on people. It's a very special race, isn't it? And you've been around it so many times, you know it better than most. But yeah, the beauty of it is, right, you've got, you know, years and years of, you know, time to put together a string of whatever you want, almost. Like, you know, you can have a whole second, third, fourth career here. It doesn't need to be a short-term thing. But you have switched in between the bike and run of late because of injury issues. Is that fair? And what's the bike brought to your sort of athletic career that was new and exciting and different? And what perspective has it given you?
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind with what the biking brought me was like a whole great bunch of people. The ultra cycling community, it's got a much more of a Caesar's Camp feel to it when you rock up at the start.
Okay.
Or Wild West. And there's some really, really nice people that I've met through it. That's been the best thing that's come out of it. Like in terms of like as an athlete, I've definitely taken away some like from the psychological side of it. Like when you're cycling, and I think the longest I did was just over 2,000 kilometers. Took me about 5 days. It was quite a few hills in there, from Vienna to Nice. And like, you just go to some dark places that you can't regularly go to as a runner. To get to those places as a runner, you've got to go through, put yourself through bodily trauma. Mm. And to get there as a cyclist, you just got to cycle your bike for a long time and not sleep much. And yeah, I really enjoyed that. I found it fascinating to kind of get into just some really kind of sad places that I wanted to be at. I wanted to be in the kind of dark, like stepping off the bike, stepping off the road, like just kind of feel like I could cry, but I'm probably too dehydrated to produce any tears kind of situations that, but not have that. Like if you do that as a runner, you're needing a couple of months to recover. Whereas you do that as a cyclist. Like I had one race from, I did it a couple of times from Naples to Sicily called the Two Volcano Sprint. And 1100 kilometers with I think it was like 25,000 meters, so it's punchy. And like I'd tried to push the sleep deprivation stuff on that, and I'd cycled through for about 36-40 hours, and I was just this really despairing. Like I was doing okay, I was still strong, like I was cycling well up hills, and I just couldn't be bothered. And I like sat on the side of the road and I just wanted to quit, and like everything was gone. Like, I didn't see the point of it at all. And I cycled to a hotel, right, which was closed. The owners opened it up for me and like cooked me dinner. They didn't need to. It was freezing cold. I slept for about 4 or 5 hours. Got back on my bike at 4 a.m, cycled along and didn't stop till the finish. Had another like 24 hours of thoroughly enjoyable cycling. And just, it was a totally new feeling. And to kind of be able to have that kind of low point and then return to the high point simply after a bit of sleep. It's not really, like if you do that, if you get to that point in a running race, you're done, you're cooked. Whereas this one, you can sleep for a few hours. And I know like in the tour, you sleep for a bit and it's better afterwards, but you're still fucked, right? Mm. Like, you're not getting on it. And you on the bike, you get back on it after a few bit of sleep and yeah, you can still fly. And it's brilliant. So yeah, really enjoyed
that. You haven't got that impact and muscle damage right on top of the fatigue. That's the main difference that you're describing.
Yeah, and if you're fueling well, like if you've got the energy going in, which is one of my strengths, then yeah, it's brilliant. You can just keep cycling forever.
How does now you're functioning better and training consistently and back to racing long, how does biking fit in? Is it always going to be there now? Is it always going to be a part of your racing and training mix?
I want it to be. In the last couple of blocks where I've kind of pushed the running volume up a bit, I've eased back on the cycling because it seems like it might have been. So I had a couple of years with injuries, and I think the initial injury was training for the track 100, and my hammy pinged, like the back, something on the back of my right leg pinged in a stride, and I jumped straight on the bike to try and keep my training up. And I'm thinking doing so, I potentially created another issue that tightened up and caused issues. So then I spent quite a long time chasing this injury, which no one could seemingly diagnose around my body. And then, I don't know if the bike causes some of that. So like I've eased off for this last couple of blocks. I love cycling and if I can fit them in together and if I can race on the bike as well, then I will. But if it causes me injuries, then it will be more running focused. But the other side of it is I don't just like doing things for the sake of it. I like doing things well. And I've noticed when I run that 50K last year, I was still predominantly cycling. It was 100K of my biggest week was 100K running, but most of the training, like it was maybe one third running, two thirds cycling, or maybe 50-50 at best. And the conditioning in the second half of that 50K or the last 3, 4, or 5 miles is what let me down. Whereas now, when I've taken the biking out, my biking's really suffered. I'm nowhere near as powerful on the bike. The physio, I think it was a compliment yesterday, said, your quadriceps have shrunk since you stopped cycling. And I was like, okay, this is yours. But the strength is the same. Like we can measure it, like objectively, the strength is the same, if not stronger. And it's more running specific, but the strength for the cycling's gone. So if I had to do well, if I had to sign up for a bike race again and wanted to do well, I'd have to lose some of my running. Again, it's not a zero. Yep. You can't just be great at both, like, because then you'd be a triathlete and just really good average. Yeah, pretty good at all three, triathlete. Really good at one. Well, stick with that. Where I'm kind of sat.
And before we go on to life as a coach, how you got into it and your role, you know, and your job now, what I just need to ask. Of all the things you've ever told me you've won at races, what are a handful of the most memorably ridiculous or shitty things that you've won either at races? Well, must be always races internationally, right? Because in the UK you tend to just get a trophy rather than a wheel of cheese. Or
I remember doing the Evesham 45 miler. I slept in a bush the night before. It's expensive to stay around there, and I helped set up the start line because obviously I was asleep there. And then I did 45 miles, and I got a pair of socks. Second place got a bottle of wine, and third place got a box of chocolates. And I was like, I'd have had either, like, I would have rather had the socks, the chocolates, or the wine. Weirdest prizes, missed some weird stuff over the years. I quite enjoyed winning some, me, Ben Riddle, and Sarah Tunstall between us won 13 and a half kilos of cheese. Sarah got the bulk of that cheese. She got 9 kilos. She got 2 4.5 kilo wheels or half wheels, so she got a full wheel. I got a half wheel that was 4.5. Oh yeah, and then we got 14 kilos because Ben got half a kilo. I won the ultra. Sarah won the uphill race and set the record, so that's why her double cheese day happened. And Ben was third in the uphill race, so he got only half a kilo of cheese. So yeah, I think we sold one of the wheels before we left. That was good.
And how much you get for a wheel of cheese? Not cheap, right?
I mean, that was like €80 for that. Oh, wow. Yeah. It wasn't, it's good cheese. All the Swiss that were there were like really jealous. And we were like standing there, like with a combined weight of I don't know, like Ben and Sarah. Yeah, we're not a heavy bunch of people. We don't look like we can eat 14 kilos of cheese. and then I ended up leaving that with a friend who had a bigger fridge. He says, yeah, look, come, we'll have a big party. So we went into his chalet. Somewhere else in Switzerland, like 6 months later, to eat this cheese with a load of other people. And we entered the local race, and I finished second, and I won more cheese.
happy days. Yeah. So if anyone needs some cheese, just follow Robbie's Athletic Pursuits and then drop him a message shortly after he's finished first, second or third in a race, basically.
What am I on recently? What did I get recently? I got a homemade woolly hat recently and bags of coffee. And that's quite useful, though, that stuff, bags of coffee.
Is this because local supermarkets are often sponsors of European races? Is that why? Is that
A lot of the races out here, you get local sponsors. So it might not be a supermarket. I have had one. I'll tell you that in a second, actually. But, like, yeah, it's just local. They go round and every local business might chip something in, be it, like, paying for the starting gantry or, yeah, like, surprises and stuff like that. And it's a really nice way of just getting the whole community involved. Because when, like, there's loads of little races out here. I won, what, 150 quid worth of petrol one the other last year. Like, an 18K road race from two sanctuaries to... And, but, like... Every town you run through, they're all out, they're out clapping and cheering, and I don't know, it feels better. You imagine that, like, I kind of imagine the UK, if you shut a road for 200 people to run up and down it, like, for any amount of time, half the locals are going to be on, like, on their driveways tooting you because they want
more. You just get shouted at and heckled.
They love that you're doing it. It's same as a tour, right? They come through, the whole town is madness for 48 hours, and they're just pleased you've come to run around their particular set of mountains.
Mm.
I had something that I was going to remind you of what I took as a victory, but it was, I got for the Wicklow Way, I got a lump of granite, like the trophy's made of granite, and it's a fantastic doorstop. I don't know if it's intended like that, but it's a doorstop for our spare room. And
is it just a piece of rock or is there a plaque on it of some kind?
Yeah, it's like painted, it's like chipped in and like great engraved.
Oh, wow.
It's wicked. And it's a doorstop, right? Which maybe it should be on a kind of side, but I love it. Every time I go in that room, I'm like, oh yeah, Wicklow Way, brilliant.
Have you ever stubbed your toe on it though?
No, because I know how tough it is. It's granite.
Yeah.
Tierney stayed in that room, Paul Tierney, and he used to have the record there, so I make sure he knows that the doorstop is taunting him.
I'm sure he loves that. I'm sure there's some sweary words coming from his mouth. Right. You are head of endurance at Centurion. You are our head coach. You manage, you're in charge of the whole coaching team and set up and what we do. But you've been a coach a very long time, and it was a gradual process, I suppose, where your love for the sport, both as an athlete and as, you know, involved with us and journalists and other things, they all came together. And the main path, I suppose, that you've chosen to follow is coaching. And I certainly consider you to be one of the top few, ultra distance especially, but all distance coaches we have here in the UK. I mean, I know you're not based here, but British anyway. Tell us, how did you get into coaching? Like, what was the journey and how has it sort of grown for you as a component part of what you do for your livelihood, as it were?
I'm never shy in saying that I think I started out as an athlete who used coaching as a way to support his running.
Yeah,
I've 100%. That's gone full circle to me being a coach who enjoys a bit of running these days. My first coach, I was thinking about this on my run today. The first coaching I did was back when I was like 13, 14 years old. I did the level one FIFA coaching or FA coaching badge, and I used to coach local football teams like junior. I used to coach like the under sixes and under sevens, which is basically like cat herding. You're just trying to stop them all escape at any one time and hope that one of them learns how to kick the ball. So I coached football all the way up through, when I stopped doing that, at university. I used to coach university teams there and coach youth teams. And when I started the running, it was later than that. And it kind of seemed like a sensible thing to do. In between time, I was teaching geography in the outdoors. So it was always like an educational twist to what I do. So I started coaching. I left my job teaching at the Field Studies Council when I had five people to work with. And then I started along the line of sleeping on people's sofas and stuff like that until I could actually make more of a go of it. So, yeah, I suppose in the last 5 or 6 years, it's accelerated in main part due to doing the Masters in Performance Coaching with University of Stirling, which was fantastic. It was one of the best things I've done as a coach.
So speak to that. What made you, because let's be honest, to become a running coach, it's the same as a PT or anything like that. There's no official set of qualifications. You don't need to have any any qualifications behind you. You can call yourself whatever you want. And that sort of, I don't know how to describe it without being sounding slightly offensive to those people out there who are just starting out. Because we, I'll be totally honest, you and I were both the same. We worked with athletes before we became more formal coaches and then went into the qualification process. But what made you go through doing such in-depth level qualifications? Why did you choose the courses that you chose at that part of, on that part of your journey?
I wanted to be a better coach. I wanted to do something that would make me better at what I do. Like I very much see it as my profession, as a career that I want to continue to improve. I just like being good at stuff, good at what I do. So like it struck me as one that would help me improve as a coach, as well as giving me a qualification that would like validate me in turn in other people's eyes. Like it wasn't that I didn't. So like you've got some qualifications that, like, again, I've got the UKA like coaching badges. I've got the endurance specific coaches and badges from UKA, and actually like chatting to some people about helping to improve those in, like some of those in future, make some more ultra distance and remote coaching elements to them. But I definitely felt before that I'd done that, that maybe it wouldn't help as much as, like, it would give me a badge, it would give me a qualification, but would it help me improve as a coach?
And yeah, absolutely.
It does. And it, like, definitely when you're doing face-to-face coaching, working within groups, and kind of this worth doing. If you're just starting out in your coaching career, like I definitely wouldn't say that it's beyond any of us to do those. If you're doing it for a while, it's still worth getting in, like, in on those courses, because at the very least you're going to meet other people in the same sphere that you're going to help you develop. The tutors are always, like, often bring a lot more to it than just the course itself. But I was Sterling, yeah, it felt like it would be a bit more challenging.
What was the course you did exactly?
It's MSc in performance coaching. It wasn't like this is elite level physiology, and this is the psychology around it. It wasn't about what you do, it was how you do it. And there were huge elements on how we interact with athletes, the coach-athlete relationship, but also how we develop as coaches. So the development of expertise was one of the fascinating bits in there. So looking, like, talking to world-class coaches, this is some of the research out there, and finding out what they felt made them, help them get to that level. And surprisingly, it wasn't, the qualifications don't often feature highly in those coaches' opinions of how they got to those positions. They're in there, but they haven't learned what one would consider expert, like, knowledge on the initial coaching qualifications done. It's the peer networks they developed afterwards. It's doing it. It's practicing it. It's having mentors and personal research and stuff like that. It kind of gave me the tools not only to improve myself during the course, but feels like having done that course for the years following, I've continued to be able to grow because of that. And that's, yeah, it was brilliant. Like, it was so much more than just how to coach. It was how to become a better coach.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's quite interesting, actually, because that's not the first thing I would jump to as you're going to get this out of this course. You know, it sounds more data and process, data oriented than it is process orientated. So that's quite interesting. And then you developed off of that into, I mean, you've gone on to do a lot of work on the nutritional side of what we do.
Yeah. So after that, I was looking for the next kind of stage in terms of, like, professional development. And there was the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, postgraduate diploma in sports nutrition. That was another 2-year course. The MSc before I was a two and a half year course. And then this one was 2 years. Someone asked me for feedback on that the other day, actually, an athlete was asking about it. And I didn't find that anywhere near as satisfying in terms of my own development. It's hard to say, because I think it was for people that already had a nutrition qualification, and it was taking that knowledge into the practical world. And I was maybe someone who'd used a lot of it practically, but didn't have the qualifications behind me. So it does, yeah, there were some interesting parts of it, but a lot of it was what we do on a daily basis. And the one thing I was hoping to get out of that course, which wasn't there, was the psychology around nutrition. That's the thing I find fascinating. It's all well and good knowing what we should eat, how we should eat, when we should eat, all this kind of stuff, but actually doing it, actually convincing someone to fuel in a certain way, or to make sure they're getting the recovery, the nutrients in for their recovery. Like, you and I both know like what we could, what we should be probably having a healthy, balanced diet and fueling our training, right? But neither of us are prime physical specimens. We don't look like the Adonises. Like, we just put a bit more protein in, James, and you'll have big muscles. Like, we like, knowing how to do stuff is one part of it, but actually trying to, yeah, the bit that I felt was missing for that one was like, it didn't actually help me. I mean, it didn't help me kind of figure out how to get people to do it or to not pick up the wrong idea from it. The main worry talking about nutrition is people kind of misinterpret the message you're trying to get across. And then you end up causing issues. That's why I did the qualification. It's such a minefield talking to nutrition because it means so much, such a different thing to so many different people.
It's the thing we get asked about the most, I think, beyond the pure, you know, what kind of training should I be doing? It almost always comes back to nutrition, right? And it's the big question on everyone's lips. It's the thing that seems to have allowed so many elite level high school and marathon distance or track and road trained athletes to make a better leap into ultras, and for the standard of the sport to just increase kind of exponentially over the 5-6 years that we've just seen, all the records being blown out of the water time and time again. And it seems to be kind of the most important area of what we do in terms of development, and something that can't really ever be 100% pinned down and is so individual, right? How much time do you think you spend talking about nutrition now with athletes versus training versus, you know, their racing pathway? You know, how does the makeup of coaching an athlete look? What does it look like now?
I guess it depends on the athlete and it depends what they're training for. So I coach people who are sub ultra, and I coach people who are like super, super ultra, and ultra distance cyclists as well. So like, in that regard, yeah, it very much depends on one, how good they are at it in the first place, and two, like what they need to get to achieve. Because I used to be like, I used to come in to tell people, like, you need to do this X, Y, and Z. And actually, it's more important to find out what they've been doing beforehand and what's worked for them in the past or what hasn't worked, and then trying to build on that. So, yeah, it very much depends on the athlete. Like, the longer you go, the bigger an impact it can have. And that's one of the nice things. Sometimes athletes just really want to learn about that, and sometimes they're less engaged in that side of it. And it's up to me as a coach to try and kind of highlight the value of it. Like, we put a lot of effort into our training, and actually, if we put the similar level of effort into other aspects of ultra distance racing, it could have as big an impact, right? You, if you want to, like, the Tour is a great example. You see people going back like year after year, and so how much training can you do in a 12-month period to get better at a race like that? But what else, what can you improve? Loads. It might be your nutrition, it might be your sleep strategy, it might be your kit, it might be your psychology, and those are probably the areas it's going to be easier if you're coming in as an elite athlete and then you're going back a year later. Like, where are you going to make the big gains? It's going to be in those areas. So I guess it very much depends, and I do talk about food a lot.
Do you, I mean, in terms of you've worked with athletes from everywhere, you know, from right the back of the pack to the likes of Hayden Hawks and what have you, who are competing for, you know, the top prizes in the sport. What have been the things that you reflect on now already in the 10 years plus that you've been coaching have been the biggest highlights? What have been both your achievements, but also theirs? What have been the highlights for you?
Highlights, coaching highlights. I got asked this in my, I've got a group of my athletes in, like a bunch of them in there, and it's just like a little social community, but it's really nice. And they asked that, and it almost feels like you're picking favourites, right?
Yeah, you need to be careful here.
Yeah, who's going to listen? That's the thing. That's the first thing. Ben Gray will be listening, so I best mention him.
Yeah.
One of the massive highlights has been working with Dan Lawson. I really, really enjoy working with Dan. He's been
like, once he discovered to use Google Drive instead of Google Maps for his training program, that is,
yeah. I mean, he even interacted when we were using Final Search. He started putting smiley face. I was getting feedback from the man. That was mad. Dan's a prime example of having to use different, like a normal kind of language that won't work well with might work with some athletes, wouldn't work with Dan. I don't know, like, just seeing like the jog stuff was cool. Like, it was really emotional watching Dan get a PB again, because not just I knew people had written him off. I knew plenty of people have said he was broken, he wasn't coming back, he was never going to do that again.
Well, he thought that himself. I think you helped him rediscover that self-belief there, you know.
It was like really, and because mine and Dan's journeys aligned a lot ourselves. Like, he was there in Turin that time. He was there. We did the same first ultra. We both did London to Brighton back in the day. He was second, I think, at that race, and I was like seventh or eighth.
Also ran that. That's crazy, isn't it? All the way back in the day, 2009. I ran 8 and 9. Yeah. Carry on.
There you go. So Dan's journey's always been on. It's like I just love about Dan is that he wants to keep learning. He wants to keep changing and improving. It's not like, okay, it's different convincing Dan than someone else. You have to use slightly different techniques, but like, it just means so much more when someone of that level kind of is still, you're still working together and finding improvements. It could just be the fancy shoes, but I like to think there's more to it than.
Oh, there's definitely more to it. I mean, you've brought structure and consistency to his training whilst reducing his volume by such a long way, and that takes guts in some ways, because you're following your philosophy and getting Dan to sort of come back down to a more reasonable volume of training. But he had raging success doing what he did before. He was European 24-hour champion, but you've taken him to a different level with a whole new approach. And on that, you know, what do you consider to be your coaching philosophy, and how has that developed over the years? Obviously, it's a never-ending journey, but what, you know, where are you at now, and how's that changed since you started?
Yeah, I remember we chat, like, I always try and make a differentiation between a training philosophy and a coaching philosophy. And I think years back, I had a training philosophy that I tried to impress on everyone, right? It was that, we need to cut out I had to do so many miles, increase the quality of it, and kind of there was a structure that I probably applied to people that maybe didn't need that particular style of training. They might have benefited from different ones, and now I guess my coaching philosophy and is more like convincing the athlete to see the value in how they could change and see what's right for them. They're all very individual. So like with Dan, if I'd have come in working with Dan and said, you need to do X, Y, and Z, you need to do less mileage, you need to do that, he wouldn't have engaged. He would have switched off quite quickly, and he would have been sneaking extra miles in. He does that now anyway. Like, we're saying that he's doing less miles. He's probably just, I just went to the shops and it was 10K away, so I jogged it. I didn't include that. You're like, I know he probably does that twice a day without including it.
But so true.
It's just taking that into account that everyone's totally different, and there are people that kind of needs very, very different stimulus in their training and trying to help them make the better decisions. That's probably my coaching philosophy. I'm there to, like, I think I've said in the past, paying a coach won't make you faster. Listening to one will. And it's like, if you can find a way to make them listen and to kind of buy into what your ideas and apply them to their situation, then that's what I try and do. I try and, like, help athletes make better decisions. That's it. Like, if they want to keep making bad decisions, or they make slightly less bad decisions because of the impact you have, that's a success. I used to be like, oh, damn, like, that person's only, they're still doing too much, they're still injured all the time. But if they're picking up 5 injuries instead of 10 injuries a year, you can look at it two ways. You're a coach who's got an athlete who's getting injured 5 times a year, and it's quite demoralizing. Or you can look at it and say, as a coach, I've helped them improve their situation. They're still adults. Yeah. They're still going to make, like, their own decisions. They've got to. If you try and force them into this kind of compliant relationship, like, you use your power as a coach to tell them what to do, it doesn't last, and they lose motivation. And any short-term success is, it's not going to stay around for too long, because they end up resenting you the second that they don't get the success that they want, because it's your fault, it's your plan. Whereas if you can convince them and educate them on potentially better ways to do things, or slight improvements, or different approaches, and they take that on board, and then they kind of, the decision, it's almost, it's teamwork, it's a partnership. If they've decided together, okay. Like, I had a lovely time with Dan. It was before one of the 24-hour champs, and he messaged me one morning. I've been trying to stop him doing big races in the build-up to this key race. And we'd said one of them, I'd be like, no, Dan, you just can't do that. And it was because of the situation with him running for Great Britain that time, we could say that there's a rule that says you can't do such a big race so close to it. But he had a multi-day after that that kind of slipped between the rules. And I couldn't tell him not to do it, right? And again, I don't think it would have been good to tell him not to do it. And then one morning, I remember it, I woke up and there was a voice note from Dan, and it was like, you know, I've decided not to do that race. I think I'm going to be better doing the shorter version and focusing on my training and getting to the next race, the A race, healthier. And I hadn't pushed it at all. And I remember having a really lovely feeling about that, because that was him making that decision. Like, it wasn't me telling him that it was a bad idea. It was him kind of going and listening and thinking, you know what, like, let's do this way. And actually, yeah, I think this is a good idea. And it's coming from the athlete. And if an athlete comes up with the idea and brings it to you, they're more likely to buy in. They're more likely to be motivated to try this long term. They're more likely to actually stick with a plan. And so, yeah, I suppose in a roundabout way, that's my philosophy. My philosophy is massively focused on education, kind of helping athletes understand why I'm setting this training, I'm setting why I'm putting any particular message across, and helping them make better decisions, but not getting too beat up if they still make interesting decisions themselves, because you're not there to tell them what to do. You're there to help them and guide them on their own journey. Because we've made some terrible decisions over the years, and part of them have made them the athlete we are today.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, old cliche, but obviously failing is the thing you learn from much more than succeeding, right? And you know, you have an N of one at the beginning. It's you, the athlete, and then that N increases over time. And all of those people you've worked with over the years and continue to work with now, it just expands your body of research and knowledge and ability to handle everything that gets thrown at you. And kind of feeding off on that subject, I mean, there'd be a lot of people out there wondering, maybe I need a coach. I mean, I think the prevalence of coaches amongst the elite end of the spectrum in our sport is now almost complete, right? You very rarely hear of athletes competing at the top end of the sport, particularly in ultra and super ultra, as you've called it there, who don't at least reference a coach or have worked with a coach before. But it's now kind of prevalent right through the mid and backpack as well. What's your opinion on, does everyone need a coach, as you've sort of put it in the past?
The examples that jump to mind, the Jim Walmsley, the Killian Jornet, Courtney DeWater, Adam Peterman, they don't have coaches, right? And it's so like you can reach, these people have reached the top, the very, very top of our game without coaches.
So just on that though, three of those athletes at least were high school coached runners, right? Do you think that's still an influence on them now? Are you sort of just looking at their sort of adult running careers, as it were?
I would say that, I guess we look at the formal coaching relationship as the only coaching relationship that counts as being coached. Whereas if you're surrounded by people, again, even if you've had some coaching in the past, or again, you're surrounded by people you look up to, you learn from, then they, yeah, I would say that there's less formal coaching in those people's careers now, but there's previous coaching, but also they're probably in contact with the people they've had help from in the past, in people in the future. And I was using there as an example, like, there are people that can reach very high levels without coaches. Because if we don't say that, someone listening will go, well, hold on a second, what about Killian?
And you go, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's got a Koros, which he tells what to do, which then tells him what to do now. So that works.
I guess that does, yeah, full circle. But what I would say is that, like, does everyone need a coach? No, right? Could everyone benefit from having the right coach? Yes. And that's because it's not just about a coach giving you a training plan that they think's best. The right coach will help you improve your own situation. Two people the two right people working together are going to make the job easier than one person working on their own.
Yeah.
That's the way I look at it.
Yeah.
So like, even if, and again, like those people I mentioned before, they've probably got people they turn to and ask about certain things. Like you've got they train with people that they're learning from. Killian strikes me as someone, I don't know him personally, but he strikes me as someone who's always trying to learn. Like, you look at the people he interacts with on social media, the stuff he talks about, like, he's trying to learn all the time. Like, he's learning.
And really interestingly, he feeds back into that learning matrix, right? You know, he'll interact with Steven Seiler or Steve House, whoever it is, publicly on Twitter and actually question back and forward. And you can see him literally trying to educate himself, but also advise, you know, what his feedback is, right? It's fascinating.
And like, I have a coach, right? And I have a coach for different reasons as well. Like, I have a coach that I want to learn from. right? So Tom Craggs is my coach, and I want to learn from that man. He knows more than me. He's a fountain of knowledge, right? I also have him there, so I might write my own plan or write it with Tom. Like I could sit down and write my own plan, right? Like surely not for 24 hour running, you're thinking like, if I should know how to write the bloody plan. It's like, yeah, I do. But then having a coach means someone else has looked at that and gone, yeah, that's, you know, that looks all right. That's more sensible. And like, otherwise I find myself like jogging to a session, rewriting it in my head, changing the week as it goes along and kind of not having as much, like it's just having someone, even if it is just someone to sense check your ideas. I don't think having a coach is having someone write a training plan for you. I think having a coach is having someone there on your team to kind of just support you in many different ways than just writing a training plan. So like, does everyone need a coach? Definitely not, right? There are people out there, and like anyone says, oh, I'm uncoachable, I just go like, you're probably just a pain in the ass, right? And, yeah. and you've got yeah. some things that are holding you back that you'd rather not have to deal with. And that's fine. Right. Like if you want to do like 1,000 ultras a month, right. And you that's what's stopping you getting faster or stopping you enjoying your running, but you don't want to change that because it's something you enjoy, then great, fine. But don't say you're uncoachable because there's a coach out there that can convince you to do 900 ultras in a month.
So feeding off from that, obviously we have a two-tier coaching structure at Centurion, the one-to-one coaching and then a training plan plus group. What's the benefit of each of those in terms of the methodology and what sort of athlete would fit right with the different approach? What do you find is the best approach for athletes and why out of those two?
Well, Training Plan Plus is the more affordable option, right? So it's one of the reasons we put it out there because we wanted more people to have access to coaching. It's more of a hands-off approach. It requires the athlete themselves to make some more decisions, even though that's something I would encourage in my one-to-one coaching too. But so Training Plan Plus, we write the plan every month. We build it for the monthly, and then any communication comes in a group setting. So they've got to be someone comfortable with like talking in a group setting, but also one of the benefits of being in a group like that is learning from a group setting. So it's not just the coaches you're learning from, it's the other athletes you're kind of focused, like you're working with that kind of bring a lot of learning together. And it can be simple things like, okay, well, hey guys, who's recce this route? And there's loads of great information. Or it could be that you're a 45-year-old mother of three who has this particular job. And me as a 36-year-old, like childless man, can't relate to that stuff. And I'll try my best, but actually within the group, there are people that can relate to your situation, can help you with it. And so that's Training Plan Plus. It's kind of, if you want to be a bit more of in a community, you want a bit more of a hands-off approach, but you want to try working with some people who like to think they know what they're doing. And we like as a coaching method, the groups one, I really do think it works. And I think it can be right for a whole variety of people. And then if you get to that point where you want more communication, more feedback, and this is where if you want to start pushing your limits a little more, I think one of the downsides to Training Plan Plus in a group setting is if someone's pushing their limits, kind of trying to reach their peak, there's more risk involved. There's more risk involved in giving someone a training plan that could break them a bit, like more like potentially. And that's where that proactive communication, where the coach is checking in on you, where you're going back and forth. It's kind of, I talk to some of my athletes daily, but at least a couple of times a week, I'm chatting to my athletes that are on the one-to-one. And if someone's in a deeper block of training, I'm checking in quite regularly. I've got someone running potentially due for tomorrow, but he might be running it today, like a 5 or 6 hour long run, right? Which is very rare for my athletes. I don't do that kind of stuff too often. But I'm going to check in on how he is. And if it was on Training Plan Plus, we might not check in until like 3 weeks later, or he has to come to us in the group and he might not do that. So it's kind of, yeah, it's like I look at one-to-one as the next step up. Like it's a nice progression. If you feel like you're not getting everything you want from Training Plan Plus and you want more interaction and you feel like you've got the potential to push harder and we're not pushing you enough. And again, Training Plan Plus, the emphasis on the athlete to push themselves that bit further, because that's where the kind of the extra control of the training is. Whereas on one-to-one, that can be a discussion you have with the coach and you progress it a bit more. And you end up developing more of a personal relationship. I can tell you a whole bunch about a lot of the people in Training Plan Plus, but I can give you a whole lot more detail about the people I work with one-to-one, because you end up, you learn so much more about a person. And in doing so, you learn about what's going to help them the most. And it's not necessarily which particular type of session. It's a whole lot deeper than that. And that comes from working with people like one-to-one. And that's why I think you can't work with, I think you get coaches coaching 200 people. I don't think that's coaching, because you can't develop that kind of coach-athlete relationship.
Well, on that subject, how do you find the right coach? How do you know that, somebody who's shouting from the rooftops and one of the biggest names in the sport that's got, how do you know that person's not coaching 200 plus people and that you're going to get what you need from that person? How do you disseminate them from the likes of, you know, the offering we have where coaches are working with far less athletes and far more hands-on?
I'd ask them. It's the first step. Ask questions. Even if you're interested in coaching with Centurion, but like you want to check around, ask questions of people. See how they respond to you. Do they respond in a positive way? Does it come across as just fluff? Does it feel like they just get you into the door? Do they not tell you? If you're somebody, you ask a coach, how many people are you coaching? Because that's pertinent information to you. Yeah. How much of your time am I paying for? Because that's good information, right? If they've haven't got enough time to respond to you, then yeah, they might be super, super organized, right? And they respond to everyone. But if they can't answer that question honestly, then yeah, maybe that's something that's a little red flag. I think people make them, one mistake I see is looking for someone who's done the race you're doing as a kind of prerequisite for coaching.
Yeah. Yep. You hear that a lot, right?
Well, like I can't bemoan this too much, because my coaching career has benefited greatly from my performances, rightly or wrongly, informing people that I'm a good coach, right? Really, you can be a great athlete and a terrible coach. You can be a terrible athlete and a good coach. You could be somewhere in the middle, right? They're just not potentially linked. And I think if you're looking for someone to coach you, more important is the potential to develop a good personal relationship with that coach than have they done X, Y, and Z race. Because you can learn about the race. The right coach will learn with you, will kind of develop more knowledge and kind of search it out, will have a network of people or work in a team like we do. There aren't many races out there that someone in our coaching team hasn't done. Right? I mean, you're picking up your fair share on that one, James. You've done quite a few races. We've got that experience. So if someone comes to one of our coaches, oh, you haven't actually done the race I'm doing, you go, yeah, you can find a coach who's done that race, but they might not be a good coach. It's kind of look at, yeah, I would like get in contact with people, ask them questions and see if they're the right fit for you. It's finding someone that you get on with. It might be that you have similar common interests, right? Which could be that the race they've done, that shows that they've got a similar common interest to you. That's the things I'd start looking at. From there, where do you go and find the right coach? Yeah, just like after that initial conversation, what we do when a new inquiry comes in, they'll pick a coach out, and we'll say if that coach has got the availability, then great, we fit them together. They fill in a form initially, and we then look at that form and we try and fit them with the right coach. And it could be that they have similar lifestyles, they could have similar family situations, similar backgrounds. I've linked people together because they've come from the same area, they don't live there now. But that means you've got a commonality with someone that, like, yeah, you might have gone to the same sweet shop as kids, right? That little connection, so much can grow from something like that, rather than, okay, yeah, you've done the MDS and I want to do the MDS, but you might not be two people who are going to communicate very well. And it's making sure that the coach, that we try and align our athletes with the right coach for them.
As you've said, I think the biggest thing on our side is the depth of resource, right? When someone's got issues or needs focus on a training plan or is going beyond the pure, function, day-to-day function of the plan, and wants to know specifically logistics or admin or whatever it might be about an event, there's a team of seven people or eight of us to draw off of, not just an N of one coach, right? And I think that team aspect to what we do and the way, you know, we interact with each other is as much a benefit as anything else. Would you say that's fair? Because initially we've all operated as individuals, right? But coming together as a collective has made us that much stronger and in depth, I think.
I go beyond that. I think we've all, we develop good networks. It's one of the things I've tried to do over the years. And it's like I'm coaching people now that some of the things they do, I've got one guy doing a duathlon. Oh, Radders is doing a duathlon. Fergus is doing a triathlon, right? I don't know. I don't know what the fourth sport's going to be. Both of those guys I've coached for donkey's years, right? For really, really long time. And they could, if they wanted to turn around and say, I want to go to a specific duathlon or triathlon coach, you go, yeah, you could, but they don't know you as well as I do. But rather we learn together. And then I go into my like contacts and I talk to people who coach triathlon. I talk to people who coach duathlon and I try and find that out. And if one of our other coaches got, say, okay, so-and-so's doing the first 24-hour race, like, can we chat to, oh yeah, hold on a second, we've got a good, but even like the wider Beyond Centurion, like chatting to people like Tierney, Sarah McCormack, we've got good relationships there with like in the community that they kind of bring, yeah, it brings it together. And I think if you're not connected in the wider sense, in the coaching, but also like beyond our sport, right? If you're looking for real expertise, you want to get into the marathon coaching, the cycle coaching, the triathlon coaching. They've had a professional sport much longer than ultra running. So therefore, there's more research, there's more kind of like experience in that world. And then, yeah, you've got the academic side of things. That was one of the wonderful things from Sterling, was that we kind of synced into that network. You chatted to, yeah, like people like Stephen Sala. You can chat to someone like him, you're going to learn a lot. But there's like Jamie Pugh, who works up at Liverpool John Moores. He's a senior lecturer in physiology there. He's a fountain of knowledge. Like, I'm picking his brains all the time. And it's great to have those kind of people in our network. But if, and the whole of our coaching team, if they need to, can tap into that as well. It's, we all have our own. It was interesting. Like, we have people we have access to. Like, it's a network where you can kind of, you know someone, right? You're on LinkedIn and you're a second connection, but who can you actually access? And like over the years, it's one of the things I've tried to build up. There are sports docs, physiologists, psychologists, different coaches in different sports that I can drop a message and they can answer a question. And likewise, they know, but like both ways, it's going to work. And I think that's something that's really important to develop. And something at Centurion, we've got built in because we've got that team around us. And then our team in itself has got their own, each coach has got a network we can tap into as well. So it's, yeah, we're definitely stronger as a collective.
Thanks. That's absolutely brilliant. Have you got any final thoughts, things you want to impart on the audience, things to think about going forward, or any message to the one slammers who are probably using this to accompany them? They're just crossing halfway or, yeah, just over halfway on their 2.5 month journey.
I don't know. Just don't get too carried away in the numbers, one slammers. Have a rest day if you really want it. No, just, you know, if you are thinking about coaching, chat to people who've been coached. Talk to other people about their experiences. It's another way if you're looking to get coaching, but speak to the people who've been through the experience and find what they took from it. There's no, like, I am a coached athlete. I'm not talking just as a coach here. I am someone who's greatly benefited from being helped by coaches in the past. So talk to others who have as well and find out what they got from it, because you'll get 10 different things that people got from it. It's not just, it might just be my high quality humor that people find the most beneficial.
Maybe.
Yeah. But again, talk to other people that have been coached. If you're interested in it, I think there's something for everyone from the right coaching relationship that they can gain. So if you're not sure if it's for you, just chat to someone.
Rob, thanks so much. Been fascinating, even for me, who knows your story better than most. It's been really insightful. And it's also, may I say, without trying to sound patronising, been an absolute pleasure to watch you develop and scream past me and in terms of the coaching side of what we do, and really sort of cement yourself as one of the, if not the preeminent coach we have here, I think, in especially in the field that you operate in. So thanks for imparting your words of wisdom. We go on from here to have a chat to each of the other coaches in our stable and get their thoughts and opinions and get some background on them as athletes and coaches and how that journey sort of is intertwined as well. So we'll be dropping those over the coming weeks. For now, thanks for listening, everybody. Rob, thanks so much for your time, and we'll speak to you all soon.
I thought we'd already stopped recording because you paid me a compliment, but thank you.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Cheers, Rob. Take it easy.
Cheers.